You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look into the world of working dogs. Dogs that sniff for explosives or drugs, find missing persons, or in our case today, the deceased. Kat Warren's interesting book about her work as a cadaver dog trainer is titled What the Dog Knows, but could be titled What the Dog Smells, as it recounts the exacting training and work of body dogs, or, as they're called, cadaver dogs. Warren recounts the story of her entry into the world of cadaver dog training, which began with an unruly, overly rambunctious German Shepherd pup named Solo. The book uses the story of Solo to tell a broader story of how we depend on working dogs, sharing the science we know about these dogs, debunking the apocryphal stories we take as fact, and interviewing animal psychologists, forensic anthropologists, breeders, and scent researchers to better understand this hidden world that dogs' sensitive sense of smell reveal. What the Dog Knows tells a story of cadaver dogs, drug and bomb detecting canines, tracking and apprehension dogs, even dogs who can locate unmarked graves of Civil War soldiers or help find drowning victims more than 200 feet below the surface of a lake. Kat Warren is an associate professor of English at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science, journalism, and creative nonfiction. And she's the author of What the Dog Knows, Scent Science in the Amazing Way Dogs Perceive the World. Kat Warren, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today, Rich. I appreciate it.
Everyone who's owned a dog has had this experience. You're walking your dog, or maybe you're out somewhere, and you're trying to go somewhere, and your dog is rooted to a spot, sniffing away. As I had a friend who referred to it as the dog was reading the papers. So what is actually going on then? Do we know?
Well, we know some things, of course, since we're not all that great at getting into dogs' heads, although we're starting to. Dogs have amazing noses. And I realized that my 2-year-old pup, there's this spot on our walk right in downtown where she was kind of going nuts down by this little creek bed entrance and really obsessed. And darned if my husband the other night didn't see a coyote pop right down into that area that she had been obsessed with.
So in many ways, when they're stopping to look around, they are sort of reading the papers, aren't they? They're getting the news of what's out around them.
They're doing the equivalent of that. And, depending on what you want in any particular day, I sometimes just let them read the papers because they're getting a lot of enjoyment out of it. And, if I've had enough exercise, stopping and letting them do that, I think they deserve to sniff now and again.
Yeah. Well, in your book, What the Dog Knows, you tell the story of worker dogs, and especially sniffer dogs, and you tell the story of Solo, a German Shepherd pup that you trained to be a cadaver dog to find dead bodies. And what prompted you to train your dog to do this? Because you've never done it before.
I had never done it before. I never thought about doing that. I didn't know the work existed. But what happened is that my husband and I got this wonderful but impossible little pup who had more energy than I expected him to have. And I'd had a couple of German Shepherds before, but he was a piece of work. And when he was about 4 months old, he'd flunked out of so many puppy classes because he was a singleton, an only pup, and it made him, to be frank, it made him dog aggressive. He just didn't understand the business of being with other dogs. And I took him to a trainer to try to figure out what to do with him. And it was she who suggested this work. She said, make him into a cadaver dog. And I had that immediate fantasy. Oh, a dead dog. Maybe that'll work. but she explained that, there's a whole category of dogs that are dedicated to finding the missing and presumed dead. Hmm. And so I started doing that with him.
Now, you'd done obedience training and had done other sorts of agility training, right?
Well, yes, I hadn't done agility training. Hmm. I'd done obedience training. And to tell you the truth, this dog was not going to be appropriate for obedience training, as a matter of fact. I just remember all those nights leaving puppy obedience classes thinking, this is it, after Solo had, snarled his way through an entire class. And to tell you the truth, I was a little tired of the obedience ring. I had already thought about training a prior shepherd to be a nursing home dog, because I'd worked in nursing homes through my teen years, and I know how great dogs can be, you know, as kind of therapy dogs in those situations. Solo would not have been appropriate for that, but he did have this great nose, and so I started training him in this strange new field, and I got hooked on it pretty quickly.
Now, one of the things your book does is, you know, you tell us the story of Solo and the travails that you just sort of related, but then you go into a bit of the science of, for example, with Solo, you give us a bit of the science that we know about dogs that come from single litters, you know, a single dog from a litter, and they are completely different than any other dog.
They can be, and you know, I don't want to discourage people from thinking about taking on a singleton dog, but they do have pretty specific challenges, and the wonderful dog trainer Patricia McConnell writes about them, and as do a few other people, and I was lucky to have a lot of good consulting help with Solo's breeder. She was amazing, and we remain friends to this day, but she coached me through so many kind of hopeless moments when, you know, I would explain what he would do, and she would come back and try to sort of help me work through it.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what the puppies learn about how to deal with other dogs from being around the other members of the litter. And it's
not analogous to humans at all. You know, people say, oh, it's like a single child. No, I mean, dogs were meant to be born into litters, and it is really difficult for them to get that puppy interaction in any other context that helps them understand what it is to fight and apologize and bite and ease up on the bite. Just a whole host of signals they exchange that singletons miss out on.
Now, you relate sort of having to teach Solo some of that your own, but what was it about cadaver training that sort of appealed to this particular dog's personality? It sounds like it just had so much more energy than you're used to seeing in a pup.
Well, you know, I think that there were several things. The work appealed to me because being a professor, I have plenty of commitments at the university and can't drop everything and hair off if a child is missing and presumed alive, right? Time is of the essence. And as this trainer said, both cynically and realistically, the dead can wait. The fact is that you can schedule a little bit, not always. When you go search here in North Carolina, very often during the summer, for instance, you need to think about searching in the morning when it's cooler or later at night. So there were all these things that suited both me and the dog, because a cadaver dog usually, vast majority of the time, is searching sectors by him or herself, right, with the handler, and so is not running into tons of other dogs. So it was appropriate for him, and it was an appropriate use of his extra energy and what trainers call drive, but which many owners know to be sort of a pain in the rear dog.
Now, just learning to train is sort of a challenge because it's not easy to get training materials, which obviously have to be human bones, things like that. I think you're going to dentists and grabbing teeth. Is that right?
I had a very wonderful dentist who would provide me teeth for training, because teeth with live pulp in them, in other words, teeth that have been extracted, are very valuable, because if you think about how long those remain in the environment and how important they can be for identification purposes, if you have bones and teeth scattered in a woods, for instance. And yes, it depends on the state that you're in and even the country what the regulations are. We're really fortunate in North Carolina to have a forensic facility up at Western Carolina University, which is what some people colloquially call a body farm.
I was thinking of the university.
No one doing that approves of the term, but but it's where there are bodies that are put out in the environment, bodies that are donated to science, and forensic pathologists and anthropologists study them to see what happens to them out in particular environments.
I was thinking of the University of Tennessee Body Farm, too, which is the really famous one.
That's the really famous one, and, you know, but I think we have now at least 10 scattered across the country. So people are really realizing the utility of these as research facilities.
But as far as you training in your own, you know, I was going to say, the one you training in your backyard, though, it's almost impossible to get body parts, though.
Right. Well, and it's not legal, right,
yeah,
in North
right.
Carolina. But, you know, I also train monthly on the site of the medical examiner's facility because we have somebody there who trains cadaver dogs. And so she helps host monthly trainings there. And then there are the things that are quite legal to have. For instance, if you have dirt that's been harvested from underneath a body that's laid out in the environment for quite some time, as you can imagine, that can be pretty redolent dirt, and it's a great training tool. You know, you need to be careful. You need to know what the laws are in your state, and you need to be sure that you're training the dog as far as possible on the entire spectrum. I mean, human decomposition scent is really complex chemically.
Yeah. And I think that's that the book gets into that of how the compounds that the dog is smelling changes over time, too.
Right. I mean, we assume that. We're still learning more, for instance, what it is exactly that is sort of the ping that goes off in the dog's head that says, that's human. And we're still learning more about those compounds and exactly what turns on a well-trained cadaver dog to say, that's the thing I'm looking for. We do know that there are differences. Well-trained dogs know the difference between, for instance, a deer bone and a human bone.
And
that's pretty important, as you can imagine.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, so the thing is they have to alert only on human remains, not other animals.
Exactly.
You tell some amazing stories in the book, one of a handler that went over to Vietnam, and it's amazing that it took until well after 2000 before they ever did this, but they took a cadaver dog over to Vietnam, and these dogs were able to alert to remains from 40-plus years ago.
Yes, and Matt Zarella actually just retired from Rhode Island State Police, although he still trains dogs, and part of it, if we go back to the history of Vietnam, we know how politically sensitive it was. The whole POW-MIA movement sprang up because of not bringing back missing servicemen. And, of course, we've never repeated that. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there have been many, many more efforts to make sure that nobody is left behind. And in times of war, you know, the fact is that we still have, of course, thousands and thousands of soldiers from World War II who are still missing, who were left on the field, because that was the only way to do it. But the Pacific Islands are filled with the remains of servicemen from World War II. Mm.
Now, one of the things your book does is tell us a sort of a small history of working dogs and how long they've been doing it. I think you're right of during World War I, these dogs that were to treat live people but wounded soldiers, they would carry medical supplies, so they would get out to the soldier, and hopefully the soldier would be able to administer first aid to themselves. But it's really only been in recent years that the military has used cadaver dogs or body dogs, if you will, and apparently it's pretty still a young science in law enforcement, isn't it?
I think it is a young science in law enforcement. You know, we can go back to the 70s to see the first uses of cadaver dogs. And it's true that what the German called, and I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, Sanitations, were these dogs during World War I that took supplies out to wounded and still alive soldiers. And so, I mean, we know back to prehistoric times that armies used dogs even for attack. But the use of cadaver dogs is really a modern use and came up really in the 70s, about the same time that the military realized that the dogs that had been over in Vietnam had been really useful. And post-Vietnam, sort of thinking, well, what are the capacities? What can we use dogs for? And that's when the serious research got going with the military, and when they sort of realized these training programs could help create mind-sniffing dogs and bomb dogs and the like. So cadaver dogs sort of date to that as well.
Today we're using dogs from bite dogs, if you will. I think that's how you refer to it, as dogs that are, you know, used in police work or in military work to hold a suspect. Yes. They're being used to sniff drugs. They're being used to sniff explosives. They're tracking live people, and they're tracking for human remains, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing is that when you have well-trained dogs, and I say that with real seriousness because it's really not straightforward to train these dogs, but when I look at a good multipurpose law enforcement dog, they are tracking both criminals and sometimes missing innocent victims. They're sniffing out narcotics. They're protecting their handlers. If need be, they're biting and holding suspects. And, you know, that last one can be, as you can imagine, controversial. And it takes a very well-trained dog to do that right. But I think that one of the things, when you look at it, is there's only one case in legal cases where there was a fatality from a dog bite, which was quite accidental. It's not that dogs can't do lots of damage, but when we think about sort of fatal use of tasers or guns, a dog starts to look very much like a non-lethal use of force, which is what the law views it as.
You write in the book, you know, there's these perceptions of how they were used in civil rights era that probably will ever preclude that from really being in wide use.
Yeah, I just, you know, the fact is that we do have these abuses, and they have to be taken very seriously and as cautionary tales. And I know very, very careful trainers and handlers where the dog is only going to be deployed as a last resort. And these are people, the handlers don't want to send a dog in where the dog might end up being killed either. So that can help too, in terms of thinking carefully before you send in a dog, right?
Right.
Because it can end badly for the dog. It is, to me, sort of a fascinating legal area, and it's a fascinating area for training. Of course, cadaver dogs don't do that. They're very single purpose.
My guest today is Kat Warren, an associate professor of English at North Carolina State University and a cadaver dog handler. Her book is titled What the Dog Knows: Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. It's now out in softcover from Touchstone Books, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the interesting things is, you know, you think once a dog is properly trained, I think there's a perception sometimes in law enforcement as well as in the general public that these dogs are very, they can't be, they're infallible in a way, but they aren't infallible. In fact, what's really interesting is you documenting the training in which handlers and people who are working with handlers really try to trip up the dog to make sure that the dog is as close to 100% as they can. And what are some of the ways that dogs can be led astray? Some of them were very fascinating because it's more on the handler than the dog itself.
Yes, and it's, you know, good trainers are trying to trip up the handler as often as they're trying to trip up the dog. And I think it's a real mistake to consider dogs infallible. I think legally you get into all sorts of trouble, and it's not fair to the dog either. I mean, dogs have excellent noses. If they're well-trained, I think they are just amazing tools, right, for law enforcement. But the fact is that dogs co-evolved with us, and we've seen everybody knows the way a dog will stare at you, or if you gaze at something across the room, the dog knows to follow your gaze and will fix on that object. You can imagine in a situation if a handler, for instance, is told that there are drugs in a particular house, right, and goes in and he and or the dog is not well trained, that expectation that drugs are going to be found can make it so that the dog will essentially false alert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or say, hey, there are drugs here, partly because the dog is so suggestible and so tied in with us. So part of the training is being very aware that what we call clever Hans, right, or that subconscious degree to which a handler can cue a dog quite innocently is something that needs to be trained against pretty constantly. It's not that you train a dog and then they're 2 years old and bam, you don't have to keep on working with them. These dogs have maintenance training their entire working lives.
And so does the handler sort of assume an air of somewhat of disinterest while the dog's working, or do you have to remain interested in the dog, but you just can't give any visual or nonverbal or, you know, intuitive cues?
You know, both. The fact is that you always have to be helping the dog. For instance, if you are doing a drug search, you're going to want to do it the same way every time. So you are going to direct the dog, right, to the front bumper, the front door inside the car in a pretty methodical way. But you are also going to know, as you say, you're going to remain uninterested and disinterested in what the outcome is. And that's really hard, you know, not just for drug work, but going out. I mean, if you're going to go out to search for somebody who is missing, you want to find that person. But it's really important to let the dog work independently. And so much of this training is simply trying to undo some of that coevolution, if that makes sense, and let the dog be the expert. It's his or her nose that needs to be doing the work, not you.
No.
And it's a fascinating area and ever-evolving.
Well, what was really interesting is some of the training exercises where, you know, they put every sort of biases in place to sort of get the handler, to expose the handler's biases. I can remember the one where they set up yellow tape in an area.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, yellow tape says, okay, it's inside there. And the handler's dog kept going outside of the area and eventually alerted on something outside of the area. And, of course, that's where the prompt was.
Yes, and I love that story. And Roy and Susie Ferguson, who are great handlers and trainers in Tennessee, set that up based on, a case that actually worked. And it's really true that we are, first of all, tend to be very obedient, right? So that whatever we're expected to do, we do it. And then there's the second thing is that when somebody says, oh, look, here's this crime tape, we want you to search inside the crime tape, but here's this dog going, wait a second, this smells over there, right? of sort of saying, you know what, let's follow the dog here. I think there's so many ways to play with handlers' minds that can really help with training.
One of the things you tell in the book is Solo, who I guess has now retired, right? Correct?
He is.
Yeah.
He is.
But you tell the story of his first successful search, and it was in a swampy area in North Carolina. That must have been a great moment, but very trying at the same time. It was very hot, and I just remember the reactions from the investigators said, you got to be kidding.
Yes, that was the day that I realized so completely fully how serious the work is.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, I mean, you do in principle because you're training and imagining, but it was a difficult search. And I was proud of Solo and his capacity working even when he was tired, and the degree to which his body language is so obvious that the sergeant who trained with me for many years and I still train with said, you know, you can read that dog like a book. So it's really marvelous to watch when he gets into scent, because you can be quite far away, but you can still see that body language start to change and know we need to slow down. There's something here.
So how does he react? What do you notice that shows that he has scented something or smelled something?
He'll slow down. He'll start to throw his head. His tail, I know this sounds very funny, it gets this funny little twist at the end, a little curl to it, and he gets sort of a little stiff-legged, if that makes sense. And dogs, when they're in scent, and you people have seen this, if a dog's going after a treat that it smells on the ground or something else, they work that scent back and forth because there's a scent cone going out, and they're working towards the tip of the cone, if you imagine one of those ice cream sugar cones,
right,
with the scent being at the very tip. And it helps them stay in scent. When they move out of it, they'll flip, right? And so you get this funny little snaky movement that comes down to the tip. And that, too, can help you figure out where the scent is coming from. And an experienced dog, you'll see them working, and you can see them actually almost tracing where the scent is in the air. And so, yeah, and so Solo was very easy to read.
Hmm. Now, one of the things you didn't try to answer, and you said this is almost unanswerable, but it gets to a sort of another sense that we ascribe all these motives to dogs that we really have no idea. And that gets to the question, how good is a dog's sense of smell? I mean, there really is no way to check that. But, you know, what is your best guess?
I think dog's sense of smell is very, very, very good. You know, the military did these marvelous experiments where they tried out other species. Pigs were just amazing, right? Pigs' sense of smell.
Right.
Truffles. Bears,
yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we have these species that have not co-evolved with us that probably have a better sense of smell, but there are actually no good comparative studies. And, you know, a recent paper came out, scientific paper, saying that humans could distinguish a trillion different scents. That's a lot. You know, and then another scientist came along and said, wait a second, there's a math error in this paper. Okay, they smell a lot. We can distinguish a lot, but not a trillion, right? So it's like we're making it up for humans. And then with dogs, people go, oh, the bloodhound nose is the very best there is. We actually don't know any of this yet. And I think that the science of olfaction has a ways to go, and that's kind of what's amazing and cool, is that what we do know is dogs' noses are very, very good, and that when you have a well-trained dog, I think it's a great tool, right? I don't think it's the only tool. I mean, dogs don't go out and do it by themselves. It takes, in law enforcement cases, it takes a team of people. And I would say inevitably that any story that has the dog out there as the lone hero is sort of misascribing heroism to that dog, when what you have are great investigators and scientists and good handlers and trainers and then a fine dog. And it's like you have enough of those, and I think it can really help.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with your continuing work in handling cadaver dogs. The name of the book is What the Dog Knows. Kat Warren, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich. I enjoyed it.
Kat Warren is an associate professor of English at North Carolina State University and a cadaver dog handler and the author of What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. It's published by Touchstone. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.